But Daniel chapter 1 is really where I'd like us to start. It's a great place to start a look at the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 1. So let's jump right at it. In the third year, this is chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, we've been talking about this for a long time. And here we finally are. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, and some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land. So, we are in approximately the year 606. In fact, if you take a peek at this handy-dandy chart, which we've gotten much more use out of than I ever expected to, but that's a good thing. I'm happy that it's been so useful for us. If you take a look at this chart, you see Daniel spans approximately the year 606 to 534 B.C., and those are the textbook years for the start of the Babylonian invasion, which set off the captivity of the southern kingdom in the midst of Babylon. And that year 534 is the textbook year, coordinated, you know, this is not coincidence, I'm sure. That year 534 is the textbook year for the rise of the Persian Empire, Cyrus, who came and, well, did to Babylon what Babylon did to Assyria. So the book of Daniel is our long-awaited look at the southern kingdom's captivity. Some of the books or articles you may read will call this an exile. Same difference, you know. John the Apostle, that is probably the other more famous exilee. Remember, he was sent where by the Roman Empire? John was exiled to what place before the end of his life? Say it again. Patmos, right. It's got nothing to do with Daniel, but just the imagery, the correlation of the exile. The Babylonians are doing to the Jews here is what the Assyrians did to the northern kingdom, right? Approximately, 115-ish years prior. In 721, when the Assyrian Empire came and invaded the northern kingdom, they displaced the people. This was obviously strategic, you know. The Babylonians don't know the lay of the land like the Jews know the lay of the land who've been living there for generations, right? So in order for the Babylonians to kind of maintain the upper hand over all these people that they are taking over and occupying, it makes strategic sense that we're going to put them somewhere they're not as familiar with. You know, they don't know all the secret meeting places if we take them out of their land and pluck them into a strange new land. They don't know how to get the upper hand on us if we take them out of their land and put them into a strange new land. I had a buddy when I was growing up. I should have picked my friends a little more carefully at times, but this fella said to me, "I'll never stop for a police officer if I know the neighborhood we're in." He said, "If I know, you know, where the streets are, and if I know how to get away, then, you know, I'll never stop for a police officer." Well, you know, that's obviously not words of wisdom there. But I think about him every time I think about what the Assyrians and the Babylonians did to the Jews, because they intentionally made it harder for the Jews to kind of turn the tables and get the upper hand on their occupiers. So that's a strategic reason for this exile or this captivity or this displacement, whatever term you prefer, whatever term the author you're reading prefers. Also, symbolically, as we've been talking about for a little while now, this is a gesture that shows God's complete and utter contempt of his people. Remember, for years, and we've gone back and seen some of the early starts of this mess, God's people, the Jews, were testing his patience and testing his patience and testing his patience. And this goes back generations. One of the reasons why there was that remarkable 40-year delay to go into the promised land was because of the disobedience of the people, right? You remember back Numbers chapter 12, Numbers chapter 11, Children of Israel version 1.0, we're talking about those who came out of Exodus, who came out of Egypt in the Exodus, rather, I should say. God wanted to give them the promised land. But that didn't happen. And who can quickly tell us why? Yeah. God said, there's the land, go and take it. And they were like, not so sure about that. The people in the land are big. They're like giants, and we're like what in comparison? Grasshoppers. And it just won't work, you know. How quickly they had forgotten that God led them right out of Egypt. 10 mighty sermons did God preach in Egypt. You might call them 10 plagues, but they were sermons from God. Preached to the one and only Mr. Pharaoh, who was in charge of Egypt, who finally, after the 10th plague, relented and let God's people go, which he should have done to begin with, but Pharaoh was a haughty man. You remember Exodus chapter 5, I imagine this scene in my mind. Moses, a single figure, walks in to Pharaoh's house, palace. And I can imagine, I dream up the opulence of Pharaoh's surroundings. I mean, Pharaoh was a rich guy. Back in these times in Egypt, they would deify their pharaohs. They would worship them. So Pharaoh was the guy, you know. And here is Moses coming to Pharaoh and saying, God says, you better do this. And I can imagine Pharaoh just kind of, you know, musing over those words, God says. Who is the Lord? Pharaoh asked. Unimpressed by this meek man, Moses, who came in making this demand from God. Pharaoh wanted to know, who is the Lord? What's going on here? You're telling me to do something from God. Ah! Well, Pharaoh learns who the Lord is. But the Lord's people don't learn who the Lord is. Because a short while later, they're telling God, no, we don't think we can do what you're telling us to do. Go in and take the promised land. That'll never work. So God says, okay, you don't want it, you won't get it. I remember this real well. My girls were fighting over a muffin or a donut or something. I don't know what they were fighting over. But they were fussing, you know. You ate the last one. No, you ate the two, blah, blah, blah. And I walked over in between this fight that was going on and got it and unwrapped it and shoved the whole thing in my mouth, which, you know, killed the argument, right? I mean, got a brownie and some peace and quiet out of the deal. God says, you don't want to go into the promised land? fine with me. So they walk in a gigantic circle. For how many years? Why 40? A year for every day they were in the promised land, spying it out. And that first faithless generation died. And a second generation comes, and God gives them the promised land, right? So from the get-go, the children of Israel were very uncustodial. I don't know. They were very aggravating regarding this promised land. And it was a beautiful promised land. You know, one of the low points of the Numbers chapter 12, chapter 13 exchange is that the people come back from the promised land and they say, guess what? God's right. It is a land that flows of milk and honey. Here's the fruit of the land. Oh, it's beautiful, y'all. You should have seen it. Be a great place to live. God is exactly right, but we can't take it. God blessed them with this land, but the people did not bless God in return. One of the side lessons we get is that sometimes our blessings from God can be misappropriated. You know, we're thankful for the luxury that we have. We're thankful for the freedom that we have. You don't have to do anything if you don't want to, you know. We're thankful for the longer days and the warmer weather and the schedule, the out-of-school schedule and all the extra time that we might be having this summer. Well, don't look now, but a lot of times these blessings from God are turned right back around and used against him. It's not coincidental, right, that when the weather gets nicer and the days get longer, church attendance sometimes kind of wobbles a little bit. As so many people have so much more on their mind, it's not coincidental that they sign up for less and less stuff that the church needs them to do. As so many people have more and more stuff on their mind, more and more irons in the fire, so to speak, it's not coincidental that they look at what they're giving and think, that's a little extra on the vacation. You know, there's a little extra spending money for the kids and whatever they have planned. These blessings that God gives us oftentimes are used against him, as was the promised land that the Jews finally got to go into. The book of Judges reminds us of a time where God's people misused the blessings that he gave them. And they would take their eyes off of God. The Bible says cyclically, you know, their heart would grow colder in its relationship with the Lord. And the Lord, each time his people wandered away from him, what did the Lord allow to happen? Book of Judges. He allowed someone to come and beat up on them. You know, if you don't want to live with God, you don't have to. God's not going to make you, but you're going to reap what you sow, right? So if you push God out of your life, he won't be there, and some bad things might happen to you, as bad things happened to the children of Israel, book of Judges. And then they would cry out to God. They'd get religion, as we sometimes say, come back to the Lord. The Lord would hear them. That's a beautiful thread throughout the book of Judges. Didn't matter how many times they left God, they could come back. God would hear them and send them a judge or a savior. We talked about that word also, maybe better meaning, a savior. And then, you know, of course, you have the people's yearning for a king, which was a pretty insulting rejection of God. So, for a long time, God has had it up to here with these people. They didn't want to live with God in their life. They didn't want to do things God's way. Fine. You don't like God's rules? Try life without God. It's no picnic. Life without God is no fun at all. And the children of Israel, what remains of them in the southern kingdom of Judah, they're going to learn the hard way that life is no fun without God. As God allows the mighty, ferocious Babylonian army to come and take what remains of God's people and this promised land. And it's here. We've been talking about it forever. Here we are. The southern kingdom falls. And what have we been saying is in the southern kingdom? What city, special city, most famous city is in, Jerusalem? And what structures in Jerusalem? The temple. Which is about to get ransacked. So the symbolism is piling up here. God's people are removed from the promised land. The temple, which represented God's presence with his people, it's going to be destroyed. God's people are displaced. And the book of Daniel gives us a peek into Babylonian captivity. So Daniel is one of the many captives taken into Babylon's land. Daniel pretty quickly finds favor with the king in his court. And the book of Daniel is an incredible journey of Daniel kind of navigating Babylonian captivity. Daniel's experiences were not typical, being highly favored by the king as he was, but we can see some things from Daniel's experiences and kind of extrapolate those to the rank and file Jews suffering this captivity. One of the first things the king does to Daniel is what? You remember? Daniel chapter 1 is where we are. Daniel had this nice name, Daniel. And the king looks at him and says, you kind of look like a Belteshazzar to me. I'm going to change your name to Belteshazzar. And it's not just, a name change. Daniel's name meant, In the Hebrew tongue, Daniel's name meant my God is strength, or my God is strong, or some close equivalent thereof, And the name Belteshazzar means Baal is strong, or Baal is my strength. It's right the opposite, right? And so Daniel's identity really is called into question. Daniel chapter 1 verse 8 makes a solemn pledge. He purposes in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies. The king wanted to, flatter Daniel and take good care of him. Presumably the king had his own purposes for doing this. But Daniel decided in a strange land with his name having just been changed, didn't know anybody around him, didn't recognize any of the sights and sounds around him, Daniel decides that I'm still going to do what God wants me to do. And there's a lesson for us, one of many that we get from the book of Daniel. Doesn't matter where you are, doesn't matter how much things have changed where you are, the Lord's word is still the Lord's word. And the Lord's will for you is still the Lord's will for you. Everybody around you might be doing the wrong thing. If everybody around you is doing the wrong thing, I'd consider going somewhere else if you can. But if everybody's around you doing something wrong, and if you're in a strange place, you know, this happens sometimes to our kids who move off to college. You know, they go somewhere new and different, and nobody knows them, and they don't know anybody, and they can be whoever they want to be. And Daniel had the opportunity to be whoever he wanted to be, and he decided to be what God wanted him to be. Great lesson there. In Daniel chapter 1, verse 9, we kind of have a callback, so to speak, of Joseph's situation. Remember Joseph, long time ago, betrayed by his brother, sold into captivity. But he's with God, and God is with him, and so he finds favor. Well, here's Daniel, betrayed by his brothers, so to speak, his fellow kinsmen. Listen, Daniel was unique among the children of Israel. There weren't a lot of people like Daniel, which is why the whole lot of them ends up in Babylonian captivity. So Daniel is, in a way, in that way, betrayed by his kinsmen. He finds himself enslaved, but he's with God, and God is with him. And so he's going to be blessed by the Lord. If you notice the last verse of Daniel chapter 1, Daniel continued into the first year of King Cyrus. So there you have it. Daniel's ministry, maybe Daniel's life even, marks very neatly the start of the Babylonian captivity all the way to its eventual end. Which makes the 12-chapter book of Daniel a very, very nice proxy study for this period. We're going to do with it, I'm going to suggest that you do with it what we did with Joel, what we did with Hosea. Use it as kind of a window into life during the Babylonian captivity, in Daniel's case. We, of course, use Joel and Hosea as windows to peek into life in the northern kingdom just prior to its fall to the Assyrian Empire. But the sands of the hourglass have kind of fallen a bit more, and we're 120-plus years later, and now the Babylonian captivity is in full swing, which is distressing. I mean, if anyone should have kind of woken up, it's these folks, because they saw what happened to the northern kingdom, and they followed the northern kingdom right off the cliff that they fell off of. So it's tragic upon tragic upon tragic. Daniel chapter 2, this sounds familiar, doesn't it? Because we ended first quarter, New Old Testament survey, with a look at Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Nebuchadnezzar dreams of world history. And Daniel interprets that dream. You remember Nebuchadnezzar's court magicians wanted him to tell them the dream so they could kind of come up with some sort of meaning to give him, and Nebuchadnezzar's deal was, no, you better tell me the dream and the interpretation. I'm not going to do half your job for you. You tell me what I dreamed, and you tell me what it means. And if you can't do that, I'm not buying what you're selling. Well, Daniel is the one able to come and convince the king that there is a God in heaven. I love that. Chapter 2, verse 28. There is a God in heaven. God's people are removed from their promised land. Daniel's in a strange place that he'd never been before. They're calling him Belteshazzar. He's never heard that name before. Nothing's the same for Daniel, except this. There is a God in heaven that hasn't changed. And Daniel resolves to honor this God in heaven with his life. You remember chapter 2, verses 44 and following, all of these kingdoms of the world. There are many, many mighty kingdoms of the world. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold in his dream. Remember that? Great kingdoms of the world, but there is a God in heaven mightier than all of these. In Daniel chapter 3 here, we see pride going to Nebuchadnezzar. You know, he was the guy. That head of gold gave Nebuchadnezzar the big head, it might seem. And so he made a statue of himself. And what did Nebuchadnezzar say had to be done to this statue? It'd fall down and worship it, right? We're going to play this sound. Chapter 3, verse 10. When you hear this sound, you better fall down and worship this golden image. And if you don't, you're going to die. Well, this is what life was like for God's people in Babylonian captivity. You know, the irony is God's people loved them some idols, man. They loved idols. And now God says, oh yeah, how do you like it now? For years and years, these Jews had been dishonoring God with their worship of idols. Some made out of gold, some made out of wood, some made out of stone. You know how idols are. And here, God is allowing Nebuchadnezzar to say, oh yeah, get a taste of this idol worship. Every time the music plays, you better do this. And if you don't, you die. Well, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego famously defied the king, and they were punished, but not really, because God saved them, right? In Daniel chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar learns of his own mortality. The book of Daniel is not in strict chronological order. So, that's a point worth making. We've made the point about the Old Testament at large that it is not arranged chronologically. It is instead arranged topically. While the book of Daniel follows a nice, fairly natural pacing, there are some portions of it that seem out of strict chronological order. No big deal. But we have in Daniel chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar in full swing of being the king. In Daniel chapter 5, Belteshazzar is king. Daniel chapter 6 jumps still again over to Darius the king, or Darius. Chapter 7, chapter 8 tell us more about Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Belshazzar, not Belteshazzar, but Belshazzar. So, no big deal. As you read the words, they tell you where we are in the narrative. And with each turn of the page, we get a sense of what it must have been like to live in this captivity. It was during this time, during these captivities, that synagogue worship became very popular. What's synagogue worship? What do we mean when we talk about that? Synagogue. What's the synagogue? Yeah. The synagogue was the gathering place for the Jews because, as we've previously mentioned, they are away from Jerusalem, the place that they were supposed to worship God, even though they didn't. They were away from the temple, the place where they were supposed to worship God, even though they didn't. And now that they are being force-fed idolatry and captivity, the people typically decide that they're going to turn back to God. It's great to see, and they can certainly repair their relationship with God, but they're going to feel every piece of this punishment that God's giving them. So, synagogue worship was originated here. They couldn't worship in the temple because they didn't know where the temple was, you know. They were in a strange new land. We don't know how to get to the temple. And oh, by the way, we're prisoners here. We can't go to the temple even if we knew how to get there. So they gathered amongst themselves and pooled their resources and would worship in synagogues, gathering places. This is something that carries over even into New Testament times, right? Jews of the New Testament age who were away from Jerusalem, they carried over this practice started here and worshiped in synagogues. The Apostle Paul was a frequent visitor of these synagogues. Some of these synagogues were big and elaborate, some were small. You know, it's kind of like church buildings today, just to each his own, depending on the amount of resources that were pooled together by whatever number of Jews were around. And in the absence of these synagogues, well, the Jews would still get together, minus the synagogue, and just meet wherever they could manage, you know. Go ahead, Sam. Do I think Daniel worshipped in a synagogue? You know, I don't know if I've ever thought about that. Sure. Sure. Right. Yeah, the events of Daniel 1, 2, 3, 4 here are rather early in this captivity. So perhaps synagogue worship wasn't as much a staple of their captivity here as it would become later on. And I suppose it would, you know, it would depend on his ability to kind of get loose and venture off and do these sorts of things. I mean, we're getting a picture of Daniel here that he has pretty wide range of freedom, being beloved by Nebuchadnezzar here as he was. Speaking of Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. And who are you going to call? Well, you call the guy who helped you out of the first one. And Nebuchadnezzar dreams about a tree, you know. And this is a big, mighty tree. And its branches spread forth wide. And it gives food and shade to people. And then this tree is cut down. And Nebuchadnezzar says, does this mean what I think it means, you know? And Nebuchadnezzar has it broken to him by Daniel. Yep, you are that tree. Let me see if I can find that verse for you. Chapter 4, verse 20. The tree that you saw, that tree is you. It is you, O king. Kings come and go. Kingdoms come and go. Kings are big and small, mighty and puny. Very lavish, very mighty, very strong, and not. Kings come and go. Kingdoms come and go. Empires come and go. But there is a God in heaven who is over all of this. And where we'll end tonight, just because you got to stop somewhere, you know, where we'll end tonight is Daniel chapter 5, which, as we previously kind of teased out, has Belshazzar as king, out of sequence, yes, but still very on point to the story. Belshazzar's the king, and he sees, what does he see on the wall? Handwriting on the wall. That's where we get that expression from, even today. See the writing on the wall. And that writing on the wall that King Belshazzar saw, Daniel chapter 5, what was the message of it? In your own words, you don't have to quote it for me. But what did that writing mean that he saw? Yeah, it means you're going to die too, buddy. All this stuff, you know, Daniel chapter 5 opens with a big old fancy-schmancy party. Gold drinking cups and the finest of food. And then Belshazzar sees this handwriting on the wall, and what it means is, this isn't going to last. Your kingdom will fall to another. Cyrus, the Persians, who we will talk about next week. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Augusta Road Church of Christ. Located in Greenville, South Carolina, the Augusta Road congregation worships God in spirit and in truth in a friendly and loving environment. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for Augusta Road COC. And if you're ever in Greenville, South Carolina, we would love for you to come by for a visit.